Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 353, titled Tides of Oil, Money, and Financial Safe Havens. This is being recorded on March 31st of the year 2002. We're going to be examining a number of different items in this program. Let me stress at the beginning that this is a speculative inquiry. Many of the items that I'm speaking about here are very well established, but what we're going to be taking a look at concerns not only tides of 20th century capital flow, but also questions of financial liquidity, oil money, financial safe havens, and there's a deliberate pun there. That would be safe haven with a small f, and also Operation Safe Haven, which was the interdicted U.S. Treasury Department operation that was aimed unsuccessfully at interdicting the Nazi flight capital in World War II. That flight capital was the foundation of the Bormann Organization, about which we've spoken so many times. I am of the opinion that the Bush family is the primary element in the Bormann Organization in the United States. I'm going to be making passing references to items that we've talked about in the past, but I will simply be making citations rather than reading many of these items. Listeners are emphatically referred to not only other broadcasts that are available online, but in particular, the detailed annotated descriptions, source descriptions of the past programs. Those are in the process of being reformatted. The programs on September 11th should be reformatted relatively soon. Listeners are encouraged to not only utilize them themselves, but to take both the audio and print files and distribute those as far and wide as possible. We're going to begin with an article that appeared in the New York Times of Monday, March 25th of 2002. This concerns a further inquiry into some names we've looked at before. New names include, in particular, the SAR Foundation, that's spelled capital S-A-A-R. That's a now-defunct foundation in Herndon, Virginia, owned by a prominent Saudi family. In turn, the SAR Foundation overlaps the milieu of Al-Taqwa that we've looked at before. Al-Taqwa, a bank of the Muslim Brotherhood. Al-Taqwa, according to a number of sources involved with Osama bin Laden and the events of September 11th. Al-Taqwa also overlapping the Underground Reich, as we have seen in past broadcasts. We're going to be taking a look also at Khalid bin Mahfouz. Khalid bin Mahfouz has some very strong connections to the bin Laden milieu, also some very strong connections to the Bush milieu, and one of the principal dynamics here concerns flows of capital and flows of oil. We'll be going into that later on. But note again the SAR Foundation, Al-Taqwa, and Khalid bin Mahfouz. New York Times, Monday, March 25th of 2002, article by Judith Miller, datelined Washington, March 24th, headlined, "The U.S. is examining whether donations by two wealthy Saudis indirectly aided terrorism." Federal investigators are examining whether terrorist operations by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda and other Islamic groups were indirectly financed by at least two wealthy, well-connected Saudis through a maze of foundations, companies, and financial institutions. The widening inquiry, which became public last week with raids in 16 homes, businesses, and charities in Northern Virginia, is focusing on the complex relationships between individuals and entities in at least 18 countries, including the United States, Saudi Arabia, Switzerland, Morocco, Turkey, and Malaysia. Though the inquiry is in its early stages, officials say that it threatens to inject new tensions into the already strained relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. While American and Saudi officials have publicly praised the two countries' cooperation in efforts to track terrorist financing, officials said the Treasury Department was increasingly frustrated by the reluctance of the Saudi government to provide information about at least five Islamic charities, among them the Wafa humanitarian organization, suspected of having financed terrorist groups. Wafa was one of the first Saudi-based charities to be identified for its alleged ties to Al-Qaeda by the Treasury Department 6 months ago. To help it decipher the complicated relationships between the groups whose offices were just raided and those that the Treasury Department has already listed as suspected financiers of Al-Qaeda, the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control has drawn up two charts that officials say focus on two entities. One chart traces relationships among a spider's web of groups and individuals associated with the SAR Foundation, S-A-A-R, a now-defunct foundation in Herndon, Virginia, which was owned by the family of Suleiman Abdul Aziz al-Raji, one of Saudi Arabia's wealthiest and most prominent families. The second chart looks at the nexus between SAR entities and individuals and Altaqua Management, a Swiss company that was recently liquidated that federal officials suspect of financing Al-Qaeda. Altaqua, again, something that we've looked at in many programs, including, for the record, 335, 336, 338, and in particular, 342, 343, and 351 and 352, as well as other broadcasts. Continuing. Officials say that they have not found evidence that SAR Foundation money was linked to Mr. bin Laden or other specific terrorist acts, but they say they are troubled by the connections between SAR and individuals and entities that the government has already designated as terrorist financiers. The SAR Foundation, which was dissolved in December of 2000, was part of an empire run by the al-Rajis that includes banks, poultry farms, clothing companies, and financial institutions. Officials said that at least two of the hijackers of the September 11th attacks had accounts in an al-Raji bank. In addition, they said, the name and Jeddah address of Salah al-Raji, Suleiman's brother, appeared in the telephone book of Wadi el-Hajj, Mr. bin Laden's Texas-based former secretary, who was convicted last year in the 1998 bombing attacks of the two American embassies in Africa. Charity tax records list Dr. Sherif, C-H-E-R-I-F, Sedky, S-E-D-K-Y, an American lawyer who lives in Jeddah, as a trustee and the secretary of the now-defunct SAR Foundation. Interrupting the narrative here, note that the SAR Foundation was dissolved in December of 2000. It was in existence for 17 years, so that would place its origin in 1983, in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan was in office, when George Bush was sitting right behind him as vice president, that's the elder George Bush, and when the anti-Soviet effort against the former Red Army in Afghanistan was in full swing, and that with the assistance of Saudi Arabia, U.S. intelligence, and among other institutions and individuals, Osama bin Laden and his Saudi backers. Continuing. Charity tax records list Dr. Sherif Sedky, an American lawyer who lives in Jeddah as a trustee and the secretary of the now defunct SAR Foundation. Mr. Sedky is also the representative of another powerful Saudi, Khalid bin Mahfouz, who for many years was the banker to the royal family. Mr. bin Mahfouz was the major donor to the now-defunct Muwafaq Foundation, a Saudi-based charity that the Treasury Department described in November as an al-Qaeda front. Mr. Sedky has denied that any of the foundation's money went to support Mr. bin Laden. In a telephone interview tonight, Mr. Sedky denied wrongdoing or knowledge of wrongdoing. He said he had not been told that the United States government was investigating him, the al-Raji's SAR Foundation, or Mr. bin Mahfouz, or one of his charities. He described his role in the SAR Foundation as peripheral. He said that around 1994, the al-Raji family asked him to go on the foundation's board because the family wanted to close it down. Mr. Sedky said that the foundation held virtually no board meetings, and that he knew little about its donations or gifts. He said he did not know, for example, why the foundation listed $1.7 billion in gifts and donations in 1998, a far greater amount than any year in its 17-year history, or how that money had been spent, or why the foundation reported a net loss of some $9 million when it was dissolved in December of 2000. Note that 1998 was the year of the embassy bombings. $1.7 billion flowed in at that time. Note that by December of 2000, the organization was described as being $9 million in debt. That's a lot of money to be flowing out where nobody knows. Continuing, My entire function, this is quoting Mr. Sedki, who again is the representative now of Khalid bin Mahfouz, formerly represented by James R. Bath, who was one of the initial capitalizers of Arbusto Energy, George W. Bush's first energy company. And people who knew him, as we've looked at in many broadcasts in the past, said that Bath did not have any substantial monies of his own at the time. James R. Bath was, however, the American representative for Khalid bin Mahfouz, as well as the bin Laden family. Continuing, my entire function was to ensure that the rules and regulations about closing down a foundation were followed, he said. The Treasury charts also provide insight into one of the government's major concerns, the nexus between SAR and the Al-Taqwa group. Among those being investigated are two men whose names appear on the chart of individuals whom officials say have ties both to the bank Al-Taqwa in Nassau, the Bahamas, and the SAR Foundation. The Al-Taqwa Bahamas operation funded in part by six members of the bin Laden family. Now, a couple of other aspects of the recent history of bin Mahfouz, of Al-Taqwa allegedly, and of Al-Qaeda. Bear in mind, again, the key names in that article, Mr. Sharif Sedki, the representative now of Khalid bin Mahfouz, and the overlapping nexuses, if I'm conjugating that right, between SAR Foundation and also Al-Taqwa. Note that SAR Foundation began in apparently 1983. It closed in December of 2000, listed $1.7 billion in gifts and donations in 98, a much greater amount than it flowed in at any time in the past, and that it was $9 million in the red when it was closed in December of 2000. We're going to review an element that we've looked at in several programs. We looked at this in, for the record, 342 and again in 347. Research and translation credit on this article goes to a member of the listening audience. This is from the Swiss German language publication Weltwoche, or World Week, the 51st week of 2001, also the first week of 2002. It has been archived online. Their website is www.weltwoche.ch. The article is titled Terror Trends, Arms Trafficking, and Completely Legal Financial Enterprises, The Connections of Islamic Terrorism Reach into the Power Centers of the West. The main title is Malice in Wonderland. It's by Johannes von Dohanyi. And of the relationship between Khalid bin Mahfouz and the BCCI and bin Laden and the Al-Shifa Pharmaceuticals plant and Al-Taqwa, we read as follows. Now, I realize that this is complex. It's why I'm repeating this from past programs. Multi-billionaire Khalid Salim bin Mahfouz, that's the fellow now who is represented by Sharif Sedki of the SAR Foundation, previously represented by James R. Bath. Multi-billionaire Khalid Salim bin Mahfouz was not merely one of the key figures in the international scandal surrounding the Bank of International Credit and Commerce, the bank used by Muslim fundamentalists, secret services, and organized crime. Bin Mahfouz was also a partner to the bin Laden family, among others, in banking and telecommunications sectors, in the oil business, and in the American pharmaceutical firm Hybridon. Both families are business partners of Saudi financier Gayit Faroun, who likewise played an important role in the BCCI scandal, and who, in the mid-1980s, became embroiled in an abortive covert operation in the Seychelles Islands to buy atomic weapons for Gaddafi. The worldwide bin Laden clan solemnly swears to have broken off any relationship with Osama, yet circumstantial evidence suggests that at least indirect contacts continue. In the book Dollars for Terror, which we've used many times in the past, it has been alleged that in fact no such break ever took place, that this was basically for PR purposes. Continuing with the Weltwoche excerpt, evidence trails also lead to Khalid Salim bin Mahfouz, whose sister, according to CIA statements, is married to Osama bin Laden. Bin Mahfouz is president of the Saudi Sudan Bank, SSB, in Khartoum. Bin Mahfouz appointed Saleh Idris as director of SSB. Idris, in turn, is the official owner of the pharmaceutical Al-Shifa factory, one founded by Osama bin Laden and destroyed in 1998 by American cruise missiles for allegedly being a poison gas factory. Saleh Idris is connected to the Tadiman Islamic Bank. This second-largest financial institution in Sudan is part owner of the Al-Shamal Islamic Bank in Khartoum, also founded by Osama bin Laden. On its board of directors sit members of the Faisal Islamic Bank, led by Prince Mohammed Al-Faisal Al-Saud. FIB's parent company is the Bahrain-registered Islamic Investment Company of the Gulf, which is in turn controlled by the Dar al-Mal al-Islami. DMI stands as the most important Saudi finance vehicle for the furthering of international Islamic fundamentalism. Just one of many threads, or merely a coincidence? The Saudi International Islamic Relief Organization, funded generously by DMI, resides in London at the same address as the Bin Mahfouz-owned International Development Foundation, or IDF. Into the IIRO allegedly flowed money of the aforementioned Al-Taqwa management of Lugano, Switzerland. It is certain that Osama bin Laden earlier received money from IIRO. Coincidence? And again, I do not think this is a coincidence, but in terms of analyzing what has taken place in connection with September 11th, I think it is very important to in some ways move beyond on the American side the figure of George W. Bush, whom I believe essentially to be a puppet. I don't think he has any real power, although he certainly for a lot of people appears to be a beloved icon. Sort of the Marlboro Man versus the Wolf Man, which are the icons of September 11th. Bush, the Marlboro Man, and Bin Laden, the Wolf Man. What's really important to understand are the institutional connections that bind the Bushes and the Bin Ladens and the Bin Mahfouzes. Those institutions are not only oil-based, but also finance-based. And I want to caution again that people should not oversimplify the events of September 11th. This is a very, very complex event. And I think that's whereas some people are inclined to say, well, there are obviously connections between the corridors of power in this country and elements of the intelligence community and bin Laden and the bin Laden milieu, that this, therefore this was a government provocation, or those on the other hand who were saying, well, this simply couldn't be, there couldn't be any conspiratorial aspects to this. I think this is an oversimplification. One wants to understand not only international finance, but also what Richard LaBaviere in the book Dollars for Terror referred to as the baklavization of American foreign policy, in which very powerful but competing interests occupy different layers, and a whole chapter in the LaBaviere text was called Is There a Pilot on Board the U.S. Aircraft? Things binding the Bin Mahfouzes, the Bin Ladens, and the Bin Bushes, as I've said, are oil, money, capital flow, and also, as I've said in the past, the Underground Reich. And I believe it is the Underground Reich and its economic component, the Deadly Bormann Organization, that pulls the strings of not only George Bush, but also the Bin Laden Organization. It has been said by people knowledgeable about Bin Laden that he's really more than anything a front man, that others, including Dr. al-Zawahiri, are the real operators of al-Qaeda. I don't know if that's the case or not, but the significance of September 11th are the institutional connections between the oil business, financial capital flow, and also the Underground Reich. Now, in the book, The Mafia, CIA, and George Bush by Pete Bruton, published in hardcover by Schapolsky Books, and copyright 1992, ISBN number 1-56171-20305, we took a look at the fact that James R. Bath helped to capitalize George Bush's first energy company, Arbusto Energy. That on page 219. On page 221, we took a look at the fact that James R. Bath then became, or was at that time, the Texas representative, the North American representative for the Bin Laden family. And on page 222 of that same text, we took a look at the fact that Bath also was working as the representative for Khalid bin Mahfouz. It was alleged in a text about the BCCI that, in fact, James R. Bath had been recruited into the CIA by the elder George Bush in order to help to secure various powerful Saudis in terms of nailing down their political and economic assets. In the book Fortunate Son by J.H. Hatfield, which has now been reissued in softcover, people who knew James R. Bath at the time said he didn't have much money of his own, and so the speculation is that the capital, which in part went to finance Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first energy company, came from Bath's wealthy Saudi clients, including the bin Ladens and Khalid bin Mahfouz. Now, I want to note also in this context that in past discussion of the book Dollars for Terror, by Richard LaBeviere, a text we're going to turn to later, subtitled The United States and Islam. This book, published in softcover by Algora Publishing, it was copyrighted 2000 in its English language edition. The ISBN number is 1-892941-06-6. On page 150 of Dollars for Terror, we took a look at the fact that the Gulf Office was a subsidiary of Al-Taqwa, the milieu of Al-Taqwa, the milieu of the SAR Foundation, and Khalid bin Mahfouz overlap one another. Bin Mahfouz married to Osama bin Laden's sister. We also took a look at the fact that a Saudi charity allegedly involved, another Saudi charity allegedly involved in financing Al-Qaeda activities and with very strong connections to the Saudi power establishment was Mercy International, described in Dollars for Terror as an offshoot of Al-Taqwa. We looked at that in For the Record 351. On page 151 and 152 of Dollars for Terror, accessed in that same broadcast, we took a look at the fact that Mercy International moved its operations to the United States in the 1990s. Specifically, it moved its operations to Michigan. That it in For the Record at 351, we also accessed an allegation from Dollars for Terror that Mercy International's relocation to the United States took place with the assistance of elements of the U.S. intelligence community, specifically the petroleum faction of the CIA. We've also looked in For the Record Program 349, among others, at the dispute that arose between the FBI and the CIA over the CIA's sponsorship of Islamist organizations, including those connected to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and the importation of some of those elements with the assistance of the CIA or the petroleum faction of the CIA and the Saudis, and those elements' connections in turn to some of the terrorist acts in the United States, including the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. What we're going to be looking at in the second half of the program is, among other things, a hypothetical explanation for why some of these Islamic elements, bear in mind that they were heavily involved against the Soviet Union in the anti-Soviet Afghan War of the 1980s. These elements inextricably linked with the Saudi power establishment, which in turn, through oil, the purchase of U.S. Treasury bills, and direct foreign investment, has a profound influence in the United States. We're going to be taking a look at tides of 20th century capital flow, tides of 20th century petroleum flow, and in particular, maneuvering in and around the underground Reich. This is going to be a very ambitious second half of the program. I'm going to do the best I can. By way of understanding one of the things that the United States is up against, and one of the ways in which I feel we are blowing it big time, and this is an area where people can take a good look in the mirror. This is where the average American meets Al-Qaeda and the underground Reich. And this is where, in terms of analyzing September 11th, this is where the average American and the American people as a whole, with some exceptions, bear some responsibility for September 11th. San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, March 14th of 2002, and this is not to be misunderstood as buying into the anti-American rhetoric that has been extant in certain circles, but rather to understand in terms of functional analysis basically how people screw themselves and how the United States is screwing itself. San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, March 14th of 2002. What we're looking at here is a flow of oil into the United States and a flow of money out. Article by Carolyn Lockheed, it's headlined, Fuel Bill Runs Out of Gas, Dateline Washington. Amid cries that soccer moms would be forced to abandon their tank-like SUVs and that their six-foot husbands would be crammed into tiny, purple people-eating European microcars, the Senate overwhelmingly rejected higher fuel economy standards for cars, sport utility vehicles, and light trucks. The 62-38 vote yesterday to leave any new gas mileage rules up to the Transportation Department ended chances that Congress will raise fuel efficiency standards for passenger vehicles last increased more than a decade ago anytime soon. Basically, this is suicidal because it is our dependence on foreign oil, and specifically Saudi oil, that has helped to make us vulnerable to the events of September 11th. That's basically why we've become the Saudis, sort of the Gurkhas for Saudi Arabia, and why we're, to a large extent, in the position that we're in. The Saudi power, economic power, and political power over the United States has to do with, first of all, oil. And that is going to be dramatically increased as a result of the failure of the Senate to pass these regulations. And in turn, I think the average American, the average gas-guzzling American, bears some responsibility for the events of September 11th. In addition to this, the Saudis have purchased and continue to finance a lot of the debt that was run up by the Reagan and Bush administrations in the 1980s. Turning to the book Dollars for Terror, and we're going to be talking about one of the elements of Saudi economic leverage. Another major American asset, the royal family, that's of Saudi Arabia, is becoming more and more involved in speculation and deal-making and continues to invest in American treasury bills. In recent years, the murky way the great Saudi families combine business and politics has directly fed the progress of the Islamist movements. This has been a determining factor in the current mutation of several of these movements, as the Saudi ambiguity has allowed for many Afghans to be rehabilitated. The latter have by no means laid down their weapons, and they pursue the holy war today by means of criminal businesses. They are found in the traditional sectors of American crime, money laundering for drug and arms dealers, as well as in the new branches of organized crime through the Islamist mafias and the ethnic religious mercenary bands. This recent evolution has not been achieved only through underhand maneuvers, but has been given semi-official and benevolent support from the Saudi and American secret services that are always inclined to make use of Islamists and their never-ending wars, wars against international communism, then today the new commercial wars in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, particularly Central Asia, where the Taliban is a major player in the new great game in progress. And we're going to continue with our analysis of Saudi economic influence in the United States, not only oil, but their financing of America's foreign debt and direct Saudi investment. And we're going to tie this in terms of presenting an analog with past events. I want to refer listeners to For the Record programs 344, 345, and 346 called Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire. Those programs analyze the political, economic, military, domestic, and foreign policy aspects of September 11th and preceding and succeeding events as being inextricably linked with one another. And the analysis being presented in this program is an extension in some ways of that type of analysis. Now, in side one, we were taking a look at something that I think, frankly, constitutes an element of national suicide by the United States, and the American people themselves bear blame for this, the refusal to accept the fact that we've got to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and that isn't by digging up Alaska and everything else. We've got to cut down on our oil consumption. Americans so far have appeared unwilling to do that. The Senate recently voted down a bill that would have mandated increased, more efficient gas mileage by American drivers and by American automobile manufacturers. The stated reason was that soccer moms don't want to give up their SUVs and their husbands don't want to cram themselves into little cars. Well, They may be cramming themselves in much, much smaller spaces. That happened to a lot of people in the Pentagon and the World Trade Center on September 11th. A lot of them found themselves fitted into spaces they had never imagined themselves being fitted into. We're going to be taking a look at debt and financial flows and oil flows. Specifically, we took a look inside one at the fact that the Saudi influence over the United States consists of three basic elements. One, obviously, is oil. Saudi Arabia alone has 25% of the world's proven oil reserves, and the Gulf states themselves have 65%. Continuing our dependence on foreign oil makes us vulnerable in that direct respect, obviously. Beyond that, with the Reagan and Bush administration debt financing of the 1980s, in which under Ronald Reagan, and in eight years, whereas the national debt was $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office in 1980, it was almost $2.7 trillion when Ronald Reagan left office and the Republicans controlled the Senate for six of his 8 years in office. It was over $5 million when George Bush left office in 1992. The Saudis hold a lot of our T-bills. They help to finance our foreign debt. In turn, the Saudis have been involved in direct foreign investment in the United States. Now, I'm going to read an article from the Wall Street Journal, or part of an article that exemplifies part of the influence of Saudi capital and beyond that, petrocapital and petrodollars in the American economy. Reading from the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, March 12th of 2002, an article by Julia Angwin, A-N-G-W-I-N. It's called Saudi Prince Boosts Holdings in Three Stocks. This is a reference to Saudi Arabia's Prince Al-Walid, who is not only a partner of Silvio Berlusconi in his media set, he's the Italian Prime Minister and P2 member. He also, that is to say, Prince Al-Walid is an associate of Youssef Nada. And the Gulf Office, a subsidiary of Al-Taqwa, is an evidentiary tributary that connects Silvio Berlusconi with Al-Taqwa and the Clean Hands investigation. We looked at that in For the Record program number 351. In turn, bear in mind that Al-Taqwa has evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of Khalid bin Mahfouz. But what we're looking at here is the recycled oil wealth of the United States. The more we pay out in terms of petrodollars, the wealthier the Saudi states become. And in turn, in order to help to offset this outward capital flow, the United States and American corporations have been in the position of having to entice just this kind of foreign investment, which gives the Saudis a tremendous amount of added leverage over the United States. Saudi Arabia's Prince Al-Walid bin Talal said he increased his holdings in Citigroup Incorporated, AOL Time Warner Incorporated, and Priceline.com Incorporated by $1 billion during the past 6 months. The prince, who is the largest shareholder of Citigroup and ranks 11th on Forbes' list of the richest people in the world, said his purchases were prompted by the low share prices in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks and the economic downturn in the U.S. Though he has suffered significant losses from prior investments in these companies, he felt that at these levels, quote, they are ridiculously priced, unquote, he said in a telephone interview. Skipping down. When Citigroup hovered around $43, it was very tempting to me, he said. The prince said he thinks the shares, which traded at $48.90 in New York Stock Exchange composite trading at 4 p.m. yesterday, are still undervalued. I think the market still doesn't realize the potential of Citigroup, unquote. The prince also increased his stake in AOL Time Warner by $450 million, bringing his stake to about 1%, he said. Again, quoting, the price was very cheap at around $23, the prince said. AOL shares have been battered since the company failed to meet its financial targets for 2001, in part because of the advertising slump. Quote, advertising will come back again, he said. By the way, we took a look at the fact that Nada Management was, according to Swiss authorities, quite possibly involved in the security speculation running up to September 11th. We took a look in For the Record 327 at the probability, or at least the possibility, that the Borman Group was centrally involved in those speculations. And I would note, as we looked at in For the Record 331, that media stocks have been significantly depressed in terms of price because of the loss of advertising revenue, making them more vulnerable to people who want to buy them up, basically. Now, note here that the prince, obviously, whose wealth comes from recycled oil money, basically, primarily U.S. Please note that the prince is the largest stockholder in Citigroup and that he also has more than 1%, or about 1%, in AOL Time Warner. This gives just this individual a tremendous amount of wealth. 1% of the stock in a major corporation is a lot. If 2% or more of a major corporation's stock is traded in any one day, it's viewed as a very significant event and can depress the stock in and of itself. So when you own about 1% of a giant corporation like AOL Time Warner, it gives you a lot of power. And when you also own, for example, when you're the largest shareholder in Citigroup, and when you also have tremendous holdings elsewhere, this gives you a lot of leverage. Now, this goes to the core of one of the major elements of the discussion, namely direct foreign investment in the American economy. And note the Saudi and also Gulf oil states' money in this. And bear in mind in the background, Bormann Capital Investment in and control of the United States. Bear in mind that the Bush family is one of the elements that we're going to be looking at in the context of a number of different examples of oil flow and of capital flow. Now, in the interests of time, I'm going to be covering a lot of ground in a relatively short period of time. I will be making references to other programs that I've talked about, other elements that I've talked about in past broadcasts. Now, we're going to be taking a look at a financial money go-round, so to speak. We're going to be taking a look at crises of international liquidity. We're going to be taking a look at a crisis at the end of World War I in the 1920s and another in the 1970s. The Bush family is invested with some of the elements. One will find, I should say, the Bush family in the context of both of the following discussions of financial liquidity. The actual investments, for example, in which the Bush family are joined with the Bin Mahfouzes and the Bin Ladens are relatively small in terms of the Bin Laden-Bin Mahfouz capital investment, but it is the type of relationship that is exemplified by the Bush family holding in Nazi Germany, and then by extension in the Bormann Organization, and by the type of relationship that is exemplified in the relationship between the Bin Mahfouz family, Bin Laden family, and the Bushes that is very, very significant in the context of the discussion. It is the institutional analysis here that is paramount. Now, end of World War I, there is a crisis that comes out of the Treaty of Versailles. Germany is required to be paying reparations to France and Britain, doesn't have the money. At the same time, powerful American investors have a lot of capital to invest. They don't want to invest it in the United States because it is subject to regulation. So they're looking for a safe haven from American financial regulation. Dulles Brothers, Allen and John Foster, senior partners with Sullivan and Cromwell, a top Wall Street law firm, are also wearing the hats of diplomats and, in Allen Dulles' case, spies. They were both at Versailles, and they helped to work out a money-go-round under the Dawes and Young plan in which American investors would basically invest in German-heavy industry and also in German municipal bonds, and in turn, this would create a capital or money, a capital flow, and a money go round. Money would be loaned to Germany, which would then pay money to France and Britain under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, thus easing a crisis of financial liquidity. In turn, American investors, by investing in Germany, would be able to find a safe haven from American regulatory considerations, and the Dulleses and the capital flow into Germany was viewed as a solution to this. Now, as we looked at, and among other books, The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by Mark Lodge, John John Loftus, rather, and Mark Ahrens, one of the principal early investors in Germany and an early investor in the Nazi Party, was George Herbert Walker, George W.'s great-grandfather and the elder George Bush's grandfather. One of the people who was a partner with him in his investments was Prescott Bush Sr., his son-in-law. This was discussed in The Secret War Against the Jews on page 358, 359, and 360. Now, the aforementioned Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell helped to mask the Bush family investments in the Harriman when he set up the Harriman 15 Holding Company. Four of the Bush companies were confiscated by the Alien Property Custodian in World War II as Nazi front companies. These were the companies whose stock was held in the Harriman 15 Holding Company. Those include the Hamburg American Line, a principal element in the Bormann Organization, and also the Union Banking Corporation, the post-war liquidation of which provided the Bush family with much of their post-war fortune. Union Banking Corporation was a joint Bush family and Thiessen family venture. The Thiessen family, a primary element of the Bormann Organization, as we've looked at in the past. Heinrich Thiessen Bornemisza, by the way, has his branch of the Bormann Organization and the Thiessen Empire based in Lugano, Switzerland, which is also the base for NADA management, or was the base for NADA management. Now, another crisis of financial liquidity occurred in the 1970s when the Arab states began increasing the price of oil. This in part a sequel to the 1973 Arab oil embargo. That oil embargo took place in response to the Yom Kippur War, and when the Arab states began to use the oil weapon, and after Richard Nixon basically eased the limits on the amount of oil that could be imported into the United States, this created another crisis of liquidity, as we looked at in some of our discussions with Christopher Simpson, the author of The Splendid Blonde Beast. Basically, so much money was flowing out of the United States and into the coffers of the Arab oil-producing states, that one of the things that was deemed necessary was to lure the Arab investors' money back into the United States. In turn, the Saudis, longtime associates of the underground Reich, the backers of the PLO, by the way, the PLO financed by Saudi Arabia, as we've looked at in numerous programs, saw this as an opportunity to begin countering Jewish influence, unquote, in the United States. We see the Bush family involved with helping to finance Nazi Germany and investing in the Nazi Party, partly as a result of the post-World War I crisis of liquidity. Money is lent to Germany in order to enable Germany to pay off France and Britain and to enable American investors to escape or to find a safe haven from American financial regulation. In the 1970s, so much money is flowing out of U.S. coffers into the Gulf oil states' coffers, including Saudi Arabia, that it is deemed necessary to begin luring some of those petrodollars back into the American economy. That is one of the areas in which we see Prince Al-Waleed and company moving up in Citigroup and AOL Time Warner. It is also that type of investing, this paradigm, that finds the joining together of people like James R. Bath and Khalid bin Mahfouz and the bin Laden family and George W. Bush, and the joining of the bin Ladens, the bin Mahfouzes, and the Bush family, among others, in organizations like the Carlyle Group that we looked at in 347. So two crises of financial liquidity, and the solution to both results in Bush connections to, on the one hand, the Third Reich and Germany, and on the other hand, to the Saudi oil-producing states. And it is exemplary of these tides of capital flow and the resulting investment climate, that both the relationship between the Bush family and Germany and Nazi Germany and the Bush family and the Saudi oil-producing elements or the Gulf oil-producing states, it is exemplary of that. And that is its significance. Now, the United States also faces a very interesting crisis in 2002, and that is the fact that we have a current account deficit. That is the total. That is the sum total of private and public debt, and ours is a record. I'm going to read an article from the part of a column from the Financial Times of Wednesday, February 27th of 2002. This is an article by Martin Wolf, and it alludes to the U.S. current accounts deficit, and it alludes to what I view as basically an untenable situation for the United States. Martin Wolf titled this column, "An Unsustainable Black Hole," subtitled, "The U.S. current account deficit cannot grow indefinitely without undermining the dollar's astonishing strength." And it is the strength of the dollar that basically is going to be presenting us with a dilemma. Now, one of the things that I noted in For the Record 344 and in 345 was that Osama bin Laden mentioned in one of his tapes, he called upon Muslims to attack American economic power. And in noting the connections that I believe to be there between the bin Laden milieu and the Bush milieu to what I call the underground Reich, the long-term effects of September 11th and the succeeding events on the American economy and the American political landscape are paramount. One of the things that George Bush has done is to basically use September 11th to call for tax cuts. We are cutting taxes, and this is going to increase the American current accounts deficit because we are placing an increasing strain on our government. We're already back to budget deficits. He's also increasing defense spending, which in the long term is bad for the economy. This is the dynamic of the tank versus the bulldozer that I've spoken about in the past. If you're going to invest your money in tanks, basically the money is coming from government issue. If you invest your money in bulldozers, you're investing capital in such a way as to build shopping centers, factories, and things that are going to employ people who are employed by the private sector. Plus, the Bush administration, in addition to cutting taxes and placing strain on the federal budget, is also basically trying to lure consumers into financing the American economy out of recession by going into debt, both by placing the federal government in red ink and consumers in red ink. We are going to be widening our current account deficit. Now, Martin Wolf discusses this as follows, skipping down. "This trend cannot last. The difficulty is knowing when and how it will end. But the longer the process continues, the more painful that ending is likely to be. In considering how it might finish, one must ask who is financing the deficit. The answer, strangely, is that we do not really know. The International Monetary Fund says the U.S. current account deficit was about $392 billion last year. The largest offsetting surplus was Japan's $91 billion. Newly industrialized Asian economies added $44 billion, Asian developing countries $24 billion, and oil exporters $51 billion. The European Union contributed nothing with a surplus of only $1 billion. But the world as a whole ran a notional current account surplus with itself of $182 billion. About this black hole, little can be said except that it must largely consist of unrecorded exports and so capital flight from developing countries. Japan's surplus is structural. Since their financial crises, other Asian economies have also found it difficult to absorb their high savings. Thus, there are sizable surplus savings looking for a safe home." And then noting the American dilemma in which increased government debt and increased consumer debt will increase our current account deficit. Skipping down, Martin Wolf notes, "Moreover, the sum of net equity inflow and net inward foreign direct investment fell from $221 billion in 2000 to an annualized rate of only $2.1 billion in the first three quarters of 2001, while net bond inflows, excluding treasury flows, ran at an annualized rate of $409 billion, up from $270 billion in 2000. This shift was not surprising given changes in equity valuations and corporate profitability, but it was also a way of hedging against valuation risks. What makes the claims relatively safe for the U.S. also makes them risky for U.S. for foreign investors. As U.S. assets become a bigger component of their wealth, they must become nervous about the currency and valuation risks. The dollar is vulnerable to such changes in sentiment. And so, again, I would note that the United States is in a very vulnerable position economically, and that by increasing defense spending and cutting taxes and luring consumers to basically go into debt in order to create a demand-based recovery from the recession, we are, in effect, committing economic suicide by increasing the American current account deficit. And this, as Martin Wolf has noted, is not going to continue indefinitely. Now, one of the things that I wonder in terms of examining the investments in the United States by some of the Islamic charities, or the presence in the United States of Islamic charities like Mercy International, the SAR Foundation, and others, is whether or not one of the questions I have is whether perhaps we are looking at an Islamic component or an extension of the Crusade for Freedom, which was an illegal domestic intelligence operation conducted after World War II, in which European fascists and Nazi elements in particular were imported into the United States to counteract the effect of, quote, Jewish influence, unquote, in the U.S. when Thomas Dewey was defeated by Harry Truman in 1948. We've discussed that at considerable length in past broadcasts, most recently in For the Record 346. The Crusade for Freedom was the godchild of Alan Dulles, overseen by Richard Nixon. The front person for it was Ronald Reagan, and the person who handled the State Department machinations to bring in these Nazis and fascists, including the Vorkommando Moscow, an SS intelligence unit, was William Casey, the manager of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, and Ronald Reagan's CIA director. What we're going to look at now is to review attempts to interdict Operation Safe Haven. Operation Safe Haven was the Treasury Department operation aimed at interdicting the Nazi flight capital at the end of World War II. And one of the principal targets of Safe Haven was Alan Dulles. The one issue, turning to The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus, the one issue upon which Roosevelt was unyielding was his insistence that after the war, the German bankers must stand in the dock at the Nuremberg war crimes trial. This is confirmed by the top secret White House Justice Department correspondence files. Skipping down. The plan was to wait until Abbs, Krupp, Flick, and the rest of the industrialists were charged. Then Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau would unleash the wiretap evidence showing that the Nazis had hidden their stolen assets in Switzerland with the help of Alan Dulles. The whole scandal of Western aid to the German economy would unravel. All the slights of the Standard Oil blackmail would be avenged. The sudden release of the Operation Safe Haven intercepts would force a public outcry to bring treason charges against those British and American businessmen who aided the enemy in time of war. The targets included not only the Dulles brothers, but Forrestal and major industrialists such as Henry Ford. And I would add, obviously, George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather of George W. From a prosecutor's point of view, indicting the German bankers first was a brilliant strategy. To save themselves, Hermann Abbs and Hjalmar Schacht would have to reveal the whole history of their sordid dealings with companies such as Ford Motor Company. Despite the shields of Swiss banking laws and the layers of corporations that Dulles had erected, he had never anticipated that the Swiss bank codes and cables would ever become public knowledge. Roosevelt and Morgenthau would have hanged him and all his colleagues for ever breaking the power of the pirates of international finance. It was a glorious dream, yet the scheme completely fell apart because someone tipped off Dulles that he was under surveillance. Skipping ahead in The Secret War Against the Jews, after the safe haven investigation, which would have gone directly to the Borman organization, was interdicted, Alan Dulles resigned from the OSS and then recruited the former director of the OSS, William Donovan, himself a Wall Street lawyer, into some of his schemes to recycle Nazi money, and they both felt that getting rid of Harry Truman in the 1948 election was essential. Returning to the secret war against the Jews, soon after the safe haven inquiry into his own Nazi money smuggling was buried, Alan Dulles resigned from the OSS and returned to New York to do what he did best, move money illegally for his clients. The old spies say that Dulles did not have to try very hard to convince OSS head William Donovan that Truman was an idiot and that the only hope for the revival of an American intelligence service was to end the Democratic Party's stranglehold on the White House in the 1948 election. Although Donovan did not know it, Dulles had conned him into serving as the front man for the Nazi money launderers. He and Sir William Stevenson from British Intelligence joined the board of directors of the World Commerce Corporation, with Alan Dulles naturally as their lawyer. The Nazi money flowed in a great circle, out of the Third Reich, through the Vatican, to Argentina, and back to, quote, democratic, unquote, West Germany. The source of the miraculous West German economic revival in the 1950s was the same money that had been stolen in the 1940s. And, of course, Thomas Dewey did not defeat Harry Truman in 1948. And so, bearing in mind the crusade for freedom, turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, with the help of the Dulles-Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon, skipping down. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. And, skipping down, in 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Quote, displaced fascists hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. So again, when I see some of the Islamic charities that were established in the United States in the 1980s, I wonder whether a combination of recycling of oil dollars into the United States, plus perhaps the perceived desire on, or perhaps the desire on the part of some of the same elements who were involved in the machinations after World War II to counteract Jewish influence may have been at work. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record, program number 350.